very high expectation of what I've always thought this franchise is, and that was the best franchise in sports.
In the moments where we are down, as players, we got to execute. Every day, I'm so fortunate to be a part of this team.
This is 49ers Plus Minus.
Hey everybody, Tim Kawakami here, co-host of 49ers Plus Minus with Matt Barros, recording from the home studio. Matt Barros, this is supposed to be a quiet time. It's not a quiet time in 49er land. We were talking about not doing a show, and then we're doing two shows this week. This is our second one. Probably, maybe not a third one. Who knows? Maybe a fourth one. Well, I don't know. 49ers, it's up to you. But there are some things going on. Yesterday was the Brock Purdy press conference discussing his new very nice contract. Nobody else but Brock. I was not surprised by that. Maybe you could have seen a John Lynch appearance, but they don't tend to do that. And he and Kyle, I believe, are on vacation. No Jed York. I guess he could have popped in there, but they don't really. They did for the Jimmy Garoppolo signing, but that was early in the 10 years. And I don't think they're really into that stuff. And Jed was at the owners' meetings anyway, all those important votes on the tush push and all that. No surprise it was Brock Purdy. They kind of like making it like just another day where we announced the player got a big contract. What were your impressions of Purdy, just of the whole scene, the whole moment?
Yeah, well, it was a typical Brock Purdy press conference where he's not overly animated or anything, but you parse his words and you get the real Brock Purdy. And I think, you know, a supposition that a lot of us had was that he was the type of guy that might take a little bit less money because he is a team player and he is duty bound and he does feel the responsibility to lead the team. And he didn't come out and say that, but, you know, he said he made it clear to his agent that, you know, making as much money as I possibly could was not the ultimate goal. Make the right amount of money. But he said, but also like, hey, let's surround yourself with a great team, a great locker room. And I think that was, you know, that's been the 49ers position point in these types of situations in the past. Yeah, we can pay you this amount, but if we pay you this smaller amount, we can surround you with a lot of great players. And I remember Colin Kaepernick had that situation. And then a few years after his contract, when he had the starting job taken away from him, he was incensed about that. And one of his arguments was that, you know, during negotiations, I took a little bit less so that the 49ers could build a great team around me. And they didn't. You know, yep. My best receiver is Quentin Patton or something like that. So, I remember that. That it can have a drawback if you as the organization don't dress up the team around him. And there's a chance that could happen. I mean, you and I have talked about wide receivers ad nauseum and how, you know, Ayuk got the deal done last year, but that doesn't necessarily mean he's going to be the guy for the future. So that's a potential issue down the line, I would say.
Yeah, I think he said there's a clear point. We said, you know, once we got to the number, then, you know, we pretty much knew there was going to be a deal. And I think the number was 53. I think the number was 53 million. I think they tied it with all the names that we've been talking about: Jared Goff, Jalen Hurts, Tua Tagovailoa. I know I'm gonna say it now. I just screwed that up several times. The low 50s. Like, get in the low. It didn't have to be 60 for sure. Dak Prescott, high 50s. Was that Trevor Lawrence, Joe Burrow? Didn't have to be there, but it had to be right in that top 10. Like, top 10. That's gonna stay top 10, even if there's some new. CJ Stroud is probably gonna go over that, but it's that Jordan Love, Jared Goff, Jalen Hurts era. And I think they got that number. And once they got that number, there are a lot of other ways you could have done it. And maybe the pay flow is going to work a certain way. And we're going to have to see the contract and see exactly when the triggers hit. But it feels like they want a 53, basically a three-year deal, right? And that's the commitment, is almost always 3 years, and then we'll see. 3 years, $53 million, if that's what this is, a year. You know, 3 years, 180 is what it feels like. 3 years, 170, 175. Once I hit that, then, okay, then I could start saying, okay, what can work out best for the team? what's the flow of this cash where it's going to work out? And I just think both sides had common sense about it. He said that, you know, again, another key thing he said is their first offer was very respectable. It wasn't an insult. And we have heard them coming back from players being insulted. Like Debo was insulted by their first offer.
Yeah, I think Kittle said or Kittle's agent said something similar.
Exactly. And they did not do this, at least in terms, you know, in Brock Purdy's mind. And I think that was very important. And I think that was what we said. It. If you're going to have a player who's willing to concede some dollars, don't try to screw him.
$50.
And I think they did. They understood the importance of this. They liked the guy. Obviously, hard to dislike Brock Purdy. I'll just say it. Now, he is, as we're walking out of there, like he's always the same. He's authentic to himself. It's not Brock Purdy putting on a show of being, you know, very unassuming and humble. He is. He just is for an NFL player. But the 49ers met that with this player, and I think they had to. If you started screwing around with Brock Purdy, when he's approaching you saying, I will give back some dollars, and you start screwing him, then that has an effect in the locker room. I think that has an effect with Kyle Shanahan. And he also mentioned, obviously, I mean, he mentioned like, yeah, there were, I think someone asked him about John Lynch saying at the combine that there's no guarantee that this deal happens, which was notable. I've noted that he kept mentioning that he is signed and asked, you know, what did Brock, what did you think of that? And he mentioned, you know, there have been times he's seen where players maybe get uncharacteristically emotional or whatever by secondhand, thirdhand, like interpreting things that someone said somewhere. And what does that mean off into the distance? And he thought it was important that he didn't do that. And he clearly didn't do that. And I think we all can read into what that might mean. Not trying to put words in his mouth, but last year they had one that was really bad. That was reaction to reaction to reaction to reaction instead of just talking to each other. That's on both sides. That's not just on Brandon Ayuk. That's on both sides. But did you feel that was kind of a, not even indirect kind of reference, almost a direct reference to last year?
I mean, I feel like this whole offseason is in reaction to last offseason. I think everything got done quickly in large part because everything got done so slowly last year. So, yeah, for sure. And the 49ers felt like that was going to happen. I mean, two different people and, to your point, two different approaches by the 49ers that they learned the lessons from last year. You know, as far as Brock Purdy, you know, to this point, he's been a under-promise, over-deliver guy, the last pick in the draft. And people, fans, love that type of guy. He's been the Evan Anderson of quarterback.
No, that high? That you put that high?
Well, I'll put it in terms that you can understand.
Wow.
So it changes now. I think that's the biggest difference. I mean, he talked about, you know, being more of a leader, and later in the night at the Dwight Clark event, George Kittle spoke, and he said he's already kind of seeing that or hearing that from Brock Purdy, that his voice is being heard more this offseason as these young guys are coming in. Brock Purdy is assuming that leadership responsibility more. But, I mean, the expectations are going to be higher. You know, you go to Cleveland and you have a bad game. When is that? In late November, and the ball slips out of your hand like it did a couple of years ago. You're just not going to get the same. It's going to be a much harsher reaction from everybody when you inevitably slip up, and that's going to happen. It happens with everybody. It happens with Joe Burrow. It happens with Patrick Mahomes. Rarely, but it does happen. That's what he's got to contend with from here on out.
Yeah, that was one question. There were so many people asking questions. I got one in. I wanted to wait till after Eric Branch finally got one in, and he was sputtering through it.
He had like 10 false starts.
Like, just go. I mean, he's being dominated in there. I didn't want to jump in front of him, but I almost did.
He was like D-Ford sprinting across the line.
Offside. The count, snap count got him every single time. So I asked one just about, you know, people are going to know classic. I asked him, like, watching all his teammates leave, and what were you thinking of all these cost cutting? He had a good answer about, you know, Drake Greenlaw, his locker mate. That's his guy. You can imagine those two guys were just like really – I don't know if kindred spirits, but they were guys you saw chatting all the time, that corner of the locker room. And he's, you know, still dealing with that, the loss of Dre Greenlaw. And that was a very authentic, you know, as you mentioned, like he's not saying a lot, but by saying that, it means a lot. But the 49ers continued to keep in touch. Like, you're a priority. This doesn't mean, you know, you can read into it. This doesn't mean you. We're still going to hit the number with you. We're just going through these things that we're trying, you know, kind of reallocate some of the funds. The other question I was going to ask him was, and I didn't ask because I don't know what the answer would be, but you've always been underrated, under, you know, discussed, last pick of the draft, lowest salary in the NFL, starting quarterback, Pro Bowl quarterback, but you're still that guy that everyone kind of writes off. Now you're the $53 million quarterback. How different is life when you're that guy? He hasn't been that guy during a season, so I don't know what he actually would have said. Maybe he's thought about it. Maybe he's approached it that way. I'm sure he's talked about it with his family. His wife does seem to have pretty major influence with him, which is great.
Yeah, he's got to get that bass buggy.
I said, you can buy like 50 bass boats right now if you wanted to. And he's got to make sure you can clear it with his wife. All great. It's all good stuff. But it will be different. You know, he's already getting, oh my God, these teams are so happy that the 49ers gave this guy all this money that makes their quarterback deals look fantastic. I get that reasoning if you don't think Brock Purdy's a really good quarterback. I happen to do think he's a really good quarterback. Again, I think last year was the bottom for him, and he still was a top half of the NFL starting quarterback with no McCaffrey, with a jumbled offensive line, with no Brandon Ayuk, with Debo not having a good year. This is a guy I think is just a really good quarterback, and the 49ers accepted that and paid him for it, but he will be under a ton of scrutiny. Jimmy Garoppolo, very different, right? When he was the guy the 49ers just traded for, and oh my God, look what he's doing. And then he gets the, you know, at the time, the richest contract in the NFL was quickly passed over. It's just different. So we will see. I think the idea of giving back dollars has gone over very well, 49er fans. Probably went over very well with Jed York, but there's a different responsibility. The other thing he talked about was there's a new energy. Like, everyone feels re-energized in there. It's the youth, I'm sure. It's, you know, some guys who were more senior than him and maybe not the greatest team leaders are no longer there. I'm reading into it. We can all imagine the one player I'm talking about. I'm not saying that's who he was talking about, but I think he does feel like this is more of his kind of, you know, younger than him. He's able to lead them. Him, and we talked about Lenore. Some of the other younger players have to have a voice, and then they can step forward into it. Did you feel that too, Barros?
Yeah, for sure. You know, I think you're right. I mean, I think it's the youth. I think it's the fact that they had an extra month and a half off, and, you know, were, you know, more eager to get back into it. And the fact that, you know, when they reported in years past, they were there, but most of those guys, especially the veterans, weren't taking part in these things. They were still recovering.
Good point.
They were missing a lot of people last year at OTAs. Christian McCaffrey, I mean, it's just a laundry list. But if I could anticipate Brock Purdy's answer to your question about how is it different, this is what I think he would say. I just remember back in 22 when he unexpectedly got put in there as the starter and did so well. He kept saying over and over again that he felt a responsibility. Like, this team was good. I mean, Jimmy Garoppolo had the team rolling at that point, and they were on a tear. They were heading to the playoffs. And he said that he felt a responsibility to keep that going. He felt a responsibility to, you know, guys like Trent Williams, to Christian McCaffrey, who was a newcomer at that point, but, you know, the ultimate professional, to Fred Warner, to all those guys. He wanted to do that for them. And so I would think that, you know, he began his career with the 49ers with a very high bar. And it probably doesn't compare to what it's become now with the contract, with the expectations. But my point is that he put those expectations on himself from jump. He didn't undercut himself. He didn't think, okay, I'm the last pick in the draft. All this is gravy right now. He put very, very high expectations, a high responsibility on himself as far back as 22. I just think that that's that's who he is, and it'll help him with this next challenge that he has.
Well, now he's one of those guys. He's one of those guys that exactly. rookies come and go, I want to hold up to that standard, that Brock Purdy, Nick Poza, Fred Warner, George Kittle, you know, that standard, D'Amato Lenore, that's the standard. He's part of that standard. You know, what this really does set up, and you've been saying it from the get, I'll give you credit, this makes these OTAs really significant. You know, I know a lot of people hate offseason 49ers NFL stuff, but I've always thought it was interesting. I missed OTAs when the Warriors have had long playoff runs, and I missed them. I want to be there. Any chance you get to see them on a practice field, you should try to get there to learn the team. But this one, with guys saying how important they are, with Kyle Shanahan saying how important they are, like, if there's some absences, which I do not expect, but if there are, that will be significant, right? I mean, they've all circled, like, this is going to be the start right here. I mean, it's really these stages where they're not on the field, but when they get on the field, it makes it even more important. Like, what's the energy? What's the vibe? What's the, you know, is McCaffrey going full speed? Is Trent Williams going full speed? Does Brandon Ayuk, he's not going to be practicing, but does he look engaged with what's happening? Or is he, you know, slumped over to the side? That is now a significant part of what we're going to read into what 2025 is going to be like. And I like that. I like them setting themselves up for it. I like them feeling like we got to restart this thing. And we'll all be carefully looking at everything. I know that. And why not? This is a team that went through some bad stuff last year and is signifying that it's going to be different. So let's see if it's different starting next week at these OTAs.
We've seen some really terrific regular season performances in recent years. We've seen them from Deebo Samuel in, what was it, 21. We saw it from Ayuk, Christian McCaffrey with all of his touchdowns and all of his yards in 23. Each of those performances was preceded by a really good spring for each of those guys. They took part every day. They were healthy. They were motivated, you know, in two of those cases by contract years. But my point is that a good spring leads to a good summer, leads to a good regular season, leads to the playoffs. And, you know, Kyle Shanahan obviously wants that on a macro basis with this team. Every coach does. That's not new. But they have the opportunity to do that this year, whereas maybe in previous years, they didn't, because of how deep they went into the playoffs, because of the contract situations, whatnot. All the business is out of the way. They can just concentrate on football.
All right, guys, do it. Listen, no excuses unless they start getting injuries, all those things. But I like a season that sets up like that. I really do. It's a clean way to go, okay, ninth year of the Shanahan-Lynch era, you're going to get a free run at it. And let's see what you can do. I would imagine they're going to do good things. We see how easy the schedule is. But they kind of cleared the field for it, and that's what teams should do. You mentioned the Dwight Clark event. I did not go to it last night, but any highlights? You talk about Kittle. What else did Kittle say? What were the other things that you kind of gleaned from a very good event, obviously a very important event for Niner land? It was all there, and what did you get from it?
Well, the guest of honor, first of all, D'Amador Lenore was honored with the Dwight Clark Award. And, you know, Dre Greenlaw has gotten it in the past, Eric Armstead, Fred Warner, just sort of underscoring that he's, mm-hmm. You know, a rising player on this team. So that was interesting to see, and just kind of confirms everything that you and I have been talking about with him being part of that new core of players for the future. But the guest of honor was Michael Zegaris, the famous photographer. And I thought I kind of understood Zegaris and what he did. There were photos from the 1960s of Zegaris like wearing a suit and Zegaris in Washington, D.C. And I had no idea about his background. I don't know if you knew this, but he worked for the Bobby Kennedy campaign, RFK's campaign, and he was in the hotel the night that he was assassinated, and that changed the course of Zegaris's life. I mean, Zegaris was going to be like a you know, a Washington insider, you know, wearing a suit to work every day in Washington, D.C., the stuffiest place in this country. And he became the opposite of that.
Yeah, yes,
for sure. So there were a lot of funny pictures, a lot of older pictures from the 1960s of Kezar Stadium, the Coliseum. It was a really nice throwback in a lot of ways. And they had a group of guys, including Anthony Adams, who's become a comedian. NFL career, and Garrison Hurst, who's hilarious. And always has been, and Fred Warner. And these guys were assigned to basically comment on a lot of the Zegaris pictures over the years. So it was a well-done event. Brian Murphy was the MC of that. It was all of Z's photos, and Brad Mangin was sort of the guy operating the slideshow. It was a very interesting watch, and I hope that they're going to have a recording of it.
Yeah, I would guess
later on to kind of show everybody. It was good stuff.
At least put it on online streaming something. A lot of talent there. A lot of Z. The photos are incredible. The rock and roll photo. Did they show any of the rock and roll photos? Or
yeah, incredible? You know, Pete Townsend.
Jagger maybe.
It wasn't any Jagger. Peter Frampton was there. Jerry Garcia made an appearance. I mean, it's impressive in a lot of ways. It shows what San Francisco really was in the 1960s and 70s. But this man, Michael Zegaris, has done football and rock and roll, which have some similarities, but they have a lot of differences too. I mean, football is a pretty conservative, mainstream, you know, hand to your heart, and rock and roll certainly in the 60s and 70s was very much counterculture.
Jesus, Brian Murphy, MC there, MC the Bay Area Sports Hall of Fame. Like, he's Mr. MC. He's just your Toastmaster.
He was in his element.
That is absolutely so. All good. You also sat. What a busy day for you yesterday. You sat down with Tariq Ahmad, personnel man, one of the chief personnel guys, running the draft. Go through the pick by pick. This is always fascinating stuff. I'll just say generally, just from reading your story, I just got how we know this, but I think they've really fine tuned how much input and how they talk to the coaches with these picks. What exactly? I think maybe it's like, here's what we like. Here's what the coach is like. Let's talk through it and let's find exactly who we want. Because every single one of them, right? He brought up a coach's input, which you don't normally hear. You just don't hear that with every team. Did that strike you too?
Yeah, for sure. And Salah said as much when he spoke a couple of weeks ago. This was maybe a dig at the Jets, but he said that, you know, in no other building are the coaches' input welcomed as much as they are here. That's been from jump. I think it goes back to John Lynch, and Lynch said this at the draft, but you know, when he was drafted by the Buccaneers, he was drafted by by the GM basically, and the defensive coordinator didn't really want him. And so it took him a while to get into the starting lineup even, and certainly into the good graces of the coaching staff. So he didn't want that dynamic when he became the GM. He was also a first-time GM. So he's allowing the head coach to take the lead. And from jump, they had meetings where Kyle Shanahan would sit down and say, okay, this is what I'm looking for in wide receivers. See his lower body, see the flexibility, see how he's driving the defensive player, you know, off the route. That's what I'm looking for. And I think them being together, and really most of the coaching staff, with Salah coming back, has been in place, that gets fine-tuned, to your point, a little bit more each year. And so they kind of find the guys that they like. I mean, I think a cornerback is a perfect example. They've found a type of player that really works for them. He's not the tallest guy, not the fastest guy. He's not a classically built cornerback, but he likes to tackle. He's gritty. He likes to fight. And so they've got now three of those guys in Renardo Green, D'Amador Lenore, and they believe Upton Stout.
Yeah, I mean, first point is if Shanahan, I was reading all those detailed things with Shanahan loves wide receivers. I go, how did he draft Dante Pettis then? I don't quite get that, because talk about a guy who did not come out of his cuts well. Terribly. He ran straight lines. That's what he ran straight lines. But anyway, I just I am always befuddled by that pick.
I think Shanahan would disagree with you strenuously on that one. I think that physically Dante Pettis is exactly what he wants. He sort of had like a rubbery lower body. You didn't know which way he was going to go.
He did, but he never cut hard. Never cut hard.
He didn't like to play in the middle.
Yeah.
And he didn't like contact. And
yeah, not good.
That was ultimately what.
Well, actually, also Kyle's gotten, you know, as you go through it, as he'd never done personnel before. He's watched his dad do it, and he was involved with it in Washington, but he didn't do it. I think he's gotten better and more refined. But also about this coaches being involved, we'll say like Kyle does have the contractual right to make every pick. Like that is his right. So he's deferred it to John Lynch in most things. But you go through the coaches when the head coach is the final say. Like he, even when John was going back through what last year, I guess they were on the clock and they almost had a pass because they were waiting for Kyle to make the call. Like he does have to sign off on every pick. It's his right. He is in charge of the football operation, period. And John Lynch is his general manager. They don't say it that way, but he is Kyle Shanahan's general manager. So it's smart to go that way because the coaches are going to have the major say. There's not going to be a time when John Lynch is going to barrel into the office and say, you must be playing this guy. He's my second round draft pick. That's never going to happen.
Right.
It can't happen. It contractually is not going to happen. It's Kyle Shanahan's call. So just want to put that out there. Any other player that?
Well, yeah. I mean, two stood out from the conversation with Tariq Ahmad. We were just talking about wide receivers. They take Jordan Watkins in the fourth round, which is a little bit higher than what people were thinking for him. And Ahmad said at one point he was the best receiver at the combine. Then he kind of caught himself and said he was one of the best receivers at the combine. Two things there. One is that I didn't really realize how hard they kind of scrutinized the combine workouts. I mean, we've all sort of come in the last 20 years to dismiss the combine as, you know, the underwear Olympics, and it's not real stuff. But apparently they pay very close attention, especially to this gauntlet drill, which Watkins did very well. And Kyle mentioned it on draft night, too, that he had the best gauntlet drill of anybody at the combine. But again, somebody that was drafted higher by this organization than people thought he would go, this will be another test of the Shanahan wide receiver. Pearsall is in that list. Pettis was in that list. Jalen Hurd. I mean, there's some misses in there. Danny Gray was a third rounder.
This guy was a fourth rounder. Danny Gray, another one.
I think that this is going to work out. I mean, I just think that this guy runs the type of routes, those crossers. He doesn't break stride when he catches the ball. He's very smooth. And I guess you have to wait and see. I think does he like contact? Is he willing to get hit? That's such a huge part for that receiver position, and you don't always get that indication in college. I think Dante Pettis is a great example of that. So that's the unanswered question with Jordan Watkins right now, but he's definitely has the tools that A, Shanahan likes, and B, sort of fits into what the receivers do. The other guy who stood out from my conversation with Ahmad is Nick Martin. And I'm starting to think that Nick Martin is maybe the second most important guy in this draft class behind Mikel Williams, because they're expecting Nick Martin not only to win the weak side job, but to sort of become what Fred Warner was a few years ago, which is the guy who sets the tone for the rookie class. He's going to be the leader of the rookie class. He's going to be out there, you know, calling plays. He might be starting out with the second team defense, for example. But, you know, this is a team that's going to rely heavily on that rookie class. And so you want a guy who comes in and galvanizes that group, leads the group, you know, gets them to stay after practice, gets them to study a little harder on the film. And they think that not only is Nick Martin, you know, a fast guy who got a lot of tackles at Oklahoma State, but he has the leadership chops to be that guy. It's a big swing on That's Nick big. Martin, another guy who was drafted higher than people thought, and they're putting a lot of responsibility on him. But you know, there's a reason for that. They think that that he can handle it. This will be another really interesting player to follow throughout his career.
Yeah, I mean, if he's not really good, I don't know how good the defense is going to be. And that's a lot to put, what, fourth rounder?
Third.
Third rounder. It's a lot to put on, you know. I don't think they would have wanted to say that about Jair Brown 2 years ago, and they couldn't say that about Jair Brown. Like, you know, like these are picks that they're investing a lot of emotion and responsibility into. We'll see. You know, I would say, why didn't other teams take him higher? But that's okay. Let's see. They might be right. They've been right about D'Amador Lenore and others. They've been wrong about some guys.
Yeah.
And sometimes they get hurt. And sometimes they can't do it on the field when you think they can do it on the practice field. But Mykael Williams and Nick Martin, man, if those two guys aren't good immediately, and we'll get indication of it, OTAs, obviously in training camp through the season, I don't know. Like, I get people telling me, oh, they're so much faster, they're so much more athletic. Well, based on what, right? Like, we need to see these guys actually do it before you can say that. And it's Martin and it's Mykael Williams. I have a very strong sense that Williams is going to be solid. Like, he's going to be solid, and he's so young, he might end up being a great player in 2 or 3 years. Nick Martin, let's just see. I haven't seen enough. I don't know if he physically will hold up. I've heard them be very high about Dean Winters, and that didn't happen. We've seen young guys highly touted come in and have been great. Some young guys highly touted and been nothing. We'll see it with Nick Martin. But there is a lot invested in him. I'll just say there is a lot invested in this guy. And in a way, did they talk about any rookie last year like that, like going into camp? I don't remember them really even talking about Pearsall that way.
Malik Mustafa got that sort of praise, that we were really impressed with him in the interview. He's a very sharp guy. It wasn't quite, I mean, the setup wasn't the same. The context wasn't the same. Mustafa ended up starting, what, 12 games, yep. 14 yeah. games? I mean, he was very good. So that Tariq Ahmad was using the Mustafa interview from 2024 to kind of describe some of the better interviews that they had. And it was clear that the Nick Martin one stood out among the rest. And what sort of kind of started him on his ascent as far as their draft board. And then when Saleh got involved, former linebackers coach, and Johnny Holland got involved, current linebackers coach, he rose a little higher. So he was somebody that, if you're looking at the front office coaching staff dynamic on the 49ers, the front office folks, the scouts, were the ones who interviewed him in Indianapolis, because the coaches don't go. Mm-hmm. And then they came back and said, hey, look at this guy. He had a really good interview. What do you think? And you got the buy-in from the coaches after that. And that's what kind of shot him up. Maybe a round higher than, you know, he might have gone otherwise. So it's sort of interesting to kind of look at that dynamic and why the 49ers tend to take players a little higher than people thought they would go. It might be just that they get consensus on a guy and feel like that's worth the extra round.
Yep. They don't really tell us who the gold helmet guys are anymore. No. But I would guess that Nick Martin would be a gold helmet. My guess, you know, just from the way they talk about guys. I'm not sure. I don't know if he was a captain. I know they love the captain thing.
Yeah, yeah. Two-time team captain.
Oh, was he? So there you go. He was almost, I would say, a gold helmet guy. And you know what? You get gold helmet guy, there's not just a thing. It's like that raises a guy up in value. That moves him up 50 picks or 60 picks. And I think that's exactly what we saw out of a bunch of those guys. Those are solid guys. Those are guys you build around. Now, are they the most athletically gifted? I think Mykael Williams is, but I don't think they have super athletically gifted. Maybe Watkins, you're the one who compared him to Randy Moss. Is that the guy?
No, like, Nayer, the undrafted guy.
Okay.
Looks like Randy Moss, but Randy Moss was a killer on the field. Yes, I don't know if this guy is.
He's your Randy Moss. Well, he's your Evan Anderson, almost Evan Anderson. But I get it. This is what builds a locker room. This is what, you know, builds cohesion and consistency. You do need athletic players, you know, who are just supremely gifted, and we'll see how many of those they've got. But you just guys you can plug in there. Hard to beat that. Hard to, you know, guys who can stay healthy, guys who can go play to the scheme, guys who the coaches trust. And I have no qualms the 49ers going after that, and just we'll see how they can play it. You got that's a lot, Barrows, for our second show of the week. You got anything else you want to throw out there?
No.
Andor, we've been talking about Andor.
Oh, I mean, Andor, yeah, I finished it. I was thinking there might be another season, but that's it. It's just two seasons. That's it.
I mean, they were going to do five seasons, the 5 years leading up to Rogue One, but they economically could not do it, I guess. So they jammed it all into the second season that just kind of just do all 4 years leading up to Rogue One. I would love there. I mean, but that's also part of what made it great is you knew it was at like, you knew like there is, that's it. Once he walks to that ship, it's over. The story's over. But I loved it. I loved it. I don't know if you loved it. I just like, I couldn't get enough of that. I was sad that was ended. So I immediately queued up Rogue One. Watch the Rogue One now. I mean, it's just storytelling at its height. I just loved it.
Yes. I mean, now that you say that it was supposed to be five seasons, I really wish it was five seasons because, I mean, they set the stage in the first season with all this. I mean, it basically is a spy thriller.
Yep.
It's like a John le Carré novel where you have all these, you know, double agents and things like that. Poor Lonnie. I felt bad for Lonnie.
Yeah, you would. You would. Lonnie would be your guy.
Lonnie was my guy. But you know, my critique, and I always have a critique of these things, is that they accelerated it too fast there in season two. They introduced the droid, you know, I know is a big fan favorite in Rogue One. But it was just too, a little bit too forced. They were in too much of a hurry to get all of that information. It would have been wonderful, kind of drawn out, you know, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy type of thing. But I can understand why it was so expensive. I mean, the sets alone, I kept thinking to myself, I mean, this does not seem computer generated. It seems like a real set here. Yeah. That alone must have been fantastically expensive. So I get it, but I do wish that they had taken their time with it because it was so good.
You can go back and 3 years ago, okay, here's the year that we skipped and we're doing that. Like I would watch that. The in-between years, like a whole four, you know, 10 more episodes of just the in-between years, I would absolutely watch that. Your guy's Lonnie, my guy, you can guess who my guy is, who my favorite character was.
Well, Andor.
Well, and other than Andor, other than the title character.
Well, they're all so good. The guy that Ben Mendelsohn plays. I mean, Ben Mendelsohn's such a good actor.
He's incredible. That would not be, I love every time he's on the thing, but that was not Luthen. My guy was Luthen.
Oh, Luthen. Yeah. Luthen is fantastic.
Just incredible, you know, pathos and energy and rage and, you know, all these things, the spirit, the beginning, the heart, the jagged edge of the rebellion. I love that. I love
so
that guy.
Is he dead at the end?
Because they had to kill him. Yeah,
I know. But at some point, somebody from the Empire says he's still alive.
No, because he didn't know yet. They didn't know.
Oh, he didn't know yet. Okay.
It was them telling Deidre, talking to her like, hey, you know, we still have this, but they didn't know that he was dead yet.
Well, and that's another great character. Deidre is, I mean, she just has that pained expression on her face. You see the tension of what it's like to work for the Empire.
Yep. Yeah. We might've seen some similar things in the NFL. No, but yeah, it just is a story for writers. It's a story for, you know, acting. It's a story for sunk in reality. A lot of people have done this. I felt this, I compare it to The Wire. Just kind of the lived in tactile, you feel the world, and it's like 17 different worlds, but you feel each one of them. It's not just this glossy thing you're walking through, like some of the Marvel movies. It's just like, I know this is a fake and I don't care. Like you feel every click, every sound, every, you know, roll of thunder, you just feel it. And that's just quality television making, quality anything, storytelling. And I loved every bit of it. And I wanted more, but I understood why. And Tony Gilroy, you know, obviously executive producer, has said they wanted the 5 seasons. They were sad they couldn't do it, but by compressing it, you know, not by their choice, it created this momentum. Like, it really did. You feel the clock. You're feeling it. And there was a benefit to that. They would have loved to tell more story. They just couldn't. So because they couldn't tell more story, they really had to compress it into those 4 years of 3 days action in each one of those 4 segments. I just thought it was really great television, and almost like knowing that it was coming to an end. It's like the end of a great book. You're like, I don't want to finish this. I don't want to be done with this. And you still had to get to the end, and you still did. So
to your point about The Wire, they showed both sides. I mean, they didn't make the Empire into, you know, a cliche or a cartoon. I thought some of the best scenes were in that sort of, you know, circular boardroom where you see the different lieutenants jockeying with each other and trying to strive ahead of one another. I just thought that was really, really smartly done. And they're obviously pulling from world history and, you know, communism and Nazi Germany and all those things. That was obvious throughout. Also current times in the United States, that those themes were apparent as well. But it just shows that a lot of thought went into it. And it's totally different than the other Star Wars movies that have come out since, 1982, where it's more cartoonish and, you know, plays to lightsaber fights and space themes. And it basically was the same movie over and over again. This had depth to it. A lot of thought went into it, and good writing, good acting equals good television. I think that's the lesson.
Just like good podcasting, this is all kind of rumbles into the same thing.
Tony Gilroy wrote a lot of this current episode.
Oh yeah, as you can tell, just the delivery, the compression. Obviously,
very expensive for him though. Very expensive.
Dictatorships are unnatural. You could just feel they loved that so much they kept on playing it. So maybe a little overplayed, but it was such great writing. You know, it's unnatural. It's freedom is more natural. The rebellions happen everywhere. They just, you got to notice them, and you got to work at it, and you got to try. So great, great lessons for the 49ers Plus Minus podcast and our review. We'll try to find another television show to review. I don't know. Any submissions, any options, let us know. Send them all to Barrows and he'll let me know about them. All right, everybody. That's the show for today. Probably get back to you next week after watching some OTA action. All right. See ya.